let's go.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Good Tuesday morning. Thanks for joining us. Lots to talk about over the next couple of hours. We're going to talk with a dentist. They've been added to the list, as their workers have as well around them. So when you're sitting in the chair, you can feel safer. Was there ever any doubt? We're going to talk about that. And plus, changes happening to the Ottawa real estate market. What are they? It's called a tease. You're going to have to stay tuned to find out. But first,
Ottawa at Work, Big Five Stories.
The Big Five Stories making news to dissect them and give us insight, as always, from the newsroom, Chris Holsky and CTV Ottawa's assignment editor, Mr. John Krupe. Welcome back, Krupe. Good to have you aboard.
Good morning.
All right, let's talk about, well, already Ontario health officials saying, oh, forget about it. We're not going to, we're not ready to recommend small gatherings without masks for those who are fully vaccinated. Where did this idea come from? The Centers for Disease Control updated the guidance yesterday. A lot of people, experts, doctors I spoke to yesterday, they were excited by this idea and saying, well, we got to definitely look at it. Well, the province says, no way, not yet. The CDC says those who are fully vaccinated, so two doses, could gather with those at low risk of severe disease without masks or even social distancing. Are we being overly cautious or smart, John Krupe?
We are one dose country right now, and that's the problem. We have to wait for the fully vaccinated two dose situation. We're probably weeks, if not months, behind the Americans. The Americans are going to have a problem in about April and May, because they're going to have 500 million doses at their disposal. We're still trying to figure out how we're going to get beyond health workers on Wednesday here in Ottawa.
Yeah.
So we have to stay cautious, extra cautious, that is.
Too soon to go have this discussion locally?
I think that we're probably still months away in Canada from even having a scenario like that coming up. In the United States, they don't have, you know, a wait 2 months guideline yet. And they have approximately, I think, 1/5 or 1/6 of their entire population has received at least one shot. So it is time for them to be asking their questions. But in Canada, we shouldn't even be, I don't think we're in a scenario where we're even looking at that until like the end of April as a best case scenario. And with the extended timeline now and getting that second shot, maybe even further than that. We may not be asking a similar question until something like June or July.
Okay, so good call. Err on the side of caution from our provincial health officials. What about this idea? They are saying you do not have to have proof of pre-existing illness when you go for your COVID-19 shot. For example, let's say you have asthma. You go there and the honor system is, yes, I have asthma, give me my shot. Is that a good idea, Chris?
Well, the question is how many people end up lining up when all of a sudden that gets rolled out. Because I think if there are too many people who are taking advantage of it, who are coming in without any kind of pre-existing health condition, I think health officials are going to notice. Like, say there are lines that are too long and there's been access that's been blocked off. They may have to be very, very careful, because I think they might actually want to push this message of saying, hey, if you're coming to this line, coming to line up or to register, and you do not actually have a pre-existing health condition, there is the risk that if we start to run out sooner than expected, that could be the first area that ends up getting slashed, which would be terrible to have some understanding of the consequences and the risks that you would cause to other people if you do try to fake it to make it in line.
So there's potential for chaos here.
Well, yeah. So if you end up in a situation, yes, where we have an extra influx of, say, 1,000 or tens of thousands of people, I guess, would have to put more strain on it, then you're taking a shot away from somebody who maybe at that time is between the ages of 65 to 70 or 60 or 65. And if you're in the government's position in that case, they're not going to all of a sudden say, well, people between the ages of 60 and up can't come, because that's what they can easily monitor. They have to kind of push some sort of presentation that says, hey, there will be consequences if too many people start to come out claiming to have some kind of underlying health issue.
Krupe, can this roll out successfully, or are there going to be issues?
Well, I would hope, you know, we're taking a look at Ottawa locally. We abided by the government regulations, the lockdown rules, for the most part, that is. Of course, there's always infractions. And I think that people, for the most part, are going to honor that system. I would hope that, you know, if your next-door neighbor has a compromised immune system, you're not going to, you know, beat them to the vaccination clinic. Let's hope that people honor that system. And I hope, you know, we've honored most of the rules so far, most of us, so let's keep it going.
As we look forward, our friends at the Ottawa Redblacks are putting out, well, basically saying you put a deposit of $50, you have first right of the options of season tickets or flex packages after the 2020 season was canceled. First game is June. Are you looking forward to that? I mean, this is normal when we start talking about Redblacks season.
Well, you know, a few weeks ago, I was looking at the road ahead and thinking, oh, absolutely no chance. Now, though, because the timelines have changed in Canada, I don't see anything along the neighborhood of the success that that Oseg was having at TD Place of sold-out games. However, maybe a few people dotted around both the north and south side. There are a lot of silver tops who are season ticket holders for the Ottawa Redblacks. Maybe some kind of dispersed crowds like what you saw in the end of the NFL. Suddenly, it's a bit of a possibility. Heck, the Redblacks could even have some fun with it. If you have a whole bunch of empty seats all over the building and only just smatterings of people in certain places, you could call it 1990s Bernie and Lonnie Gleiberman night. Or when the Argos are playing, if Toronto is on a road game, you could say it's make the Argos feel at home night. I mean, I think now all of a sudden the CFL coming back in the summer is an option. And really, though, the league needs it. They need it because attendance is what they need to survive.
Could we have a Eugene Melnick night? Yeah, too soon. Bad joke. Kruppi, what do you think? Going to TD Place?
Well, you know, I think the Redblacks are looking at June, July. They could even delay the season for 3 or 4 weeks because, you know, by then a big chunk of us will be vaccinated. But why? Tell me why the Ottawa Senators right now can't have 2,000 or 3,000 people at a game. Why not? I mean, if it's financially feasible for the owner, you know, they're having crowds in various NHL cities. Opening day in baseball, Fenway, Wrigley Field, they're all going to have fans. Less than capacity, obviously, 10, 20% at the most. But why not? If it's done with protocols.
I think what's going to happen is that we may end up getting a point in Ontario, even within the next couple of months, of perhaps having whether people can be inside these arenas based on the color-coded system. I think if we made that switch or made that flip in Ottawa, we'd probably be at risk at losing it almost immediately because going to a sports arena does not sound like a red zone activity.
Yeah, I'll give up a Sens game to keep in the orange zone, I said the man who is a Habs fan. But
well, we're one of the only markets that we'd even be looking at that as even a possibility, to be honest, because do you think they'd want to do that in Montreal right now? No. In Toronto, absolutely not.
No. I mean, they had 600 cases, although there was a data issue yesterday. But, I mean, they opened yesterday in parts of, you know, the GTA, and they had like 600 cases. And you sit here and you go, what? It's not working. These measures are not working. They have not been able to dine in for over 200 days in the Toronto 416. I can't imagine, and they're still getting 600 a day, that they're going to be able to get a handle on this.
I think it's much more feasible for the CFL to start playing games in this country, honestly, because you're talking about a couple of months from now, entirely different landscape.
Uh-huh.
And also the big factor is every stadium, I think except for Vancouver, is outdoors. And that's a huge difference compared to the indoor environment of the CTC.
What's your favorite band right now?
My favorite band in the world right
now?
That
you would listen to right now. I'll tell you why in a second. Do you like the Foo Fighters?
They're okay.
Okay.
I want to see Bruce Springsteen go on a reunion tour.
All right, there you go. So Bruce Springsteen has now booked the Canadian Tire Center for September 1st. You going?
September, I would take the risk for that.
You would?
Yeah.
June 15th.
No.
See how I did that?
Yeah, probably not.
Too soon, huh?
Yes.
Kruppi, what do you think? When are you ready to go back into the Canadian Tire Center to see your favorite act?
I want to see the percentage of vaccinations in the city, locally, and across the country. And it brings up a question. What about Blues Fest in July? You know, earlier Dr. Etches said maybe not for those large concerts. But what if we're all vaccinated, or a big chunk of us are vaccinated
by Canada Day,
by June, July 1st?
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, then we get our vaccination passport. How do you feel about that idea? If you know, never mind traveling, which is the big issue when it comes to the vaccine passport. But what if it means you can go to Blues Fest? Are you okay with it, Kruppi?
Well, if you're vaccinated, why do you need a passport? That's my thinking on this one.
To prove it? Do you really want to? Do you want the honor system of someone who's sitting next to you, who's a diehard, you know, Blues Fest fan, and you're taking his or her word for it?
Well, if I'm fully vaccinated, I'm still carrying the virus, perhaps. They don't know for sure.
But you're protected.
He or she may be in more danger than me.
That's it. Given the age projections right now, though, even for the month of July, oh, that's going to be so close. And could you, if you are an organizer for Blues Fest right now, you got to be asking, can we turn a profit based on perhaps partial attendance on this? And if we start organizing and then all of a sudden we can't do it in July, that's devastating.
So do we keep the borders closed all summer long too, just for the same reasons? Or, you know, if shouldn't we all be adults and decide whether we want to go to Blues Fest or, you know, travel?
Well, we're getting to that point where people are going to say, you know what, let me decide. I don't want to be Texas here or Florida.
Right.
But we are getting to the point where people are going to say, you know what, let me take the risk. The vaccinations are out. I'm not talking about right now, maybe in June or July.
Mm-hmm.
And let me take my own risk, and maybe we're headed into that direction, maybe not.
You know, if it's G7 countries, which is what was rumbled about over the course of the weekend, I think we need to take a serious look at this, because even if you're just talking about land border crossings between Canada and the U.S., or the short distance between the U.K. and France overseas, or Germany and Italy and the like, it would be good for the economy, it'd be good for our industry. If people are safe to travel, having this one piece of proof, I think, makes their life easier, especially in a neighboring country. We aren't talking about flying out to Ghana or something like that. The amount of land travel that even exists just between our two countries, it could make a significant difference and maybe even speed things up.
Well, I know that there are issues of privacy around the vaccination passport, and that was the big thing. We even talked with a lawyer on CTV Morning Live this morning about it, and I thought, heck, what? So you've seen I'm vaccinated. What is the issue?
Yeah, who's going to be afraid to tell someone they've been vaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, aren't we looking for problems that don't exist? Isn't this a solution without a problem?
You look at America right now. I know they're not traveling overseas, but we're starting to see the airline industry get out of its doldrums in the U.S. at least. 1.5 million people traveled on the weekend. The vaccination, what, they're doing 2 million a day?
Yeah.
So it's coming. It's coming. We're weeks, months behind, but you can see that buildup happening here. Hopefully it stays that way. And all these vaccination passports, football games, baseball games, concerts, we're going to have that discussion more often in the next few weeks.
Hopefully we just don't end up with something like spring break in Florida right now. Yeesh.
Yeah, exactly. Although it's going to feel like spring here. We need it, though. We're calling what it's called, fake spring around here?
Fake spring.
Fake spring. It's like fake news. Okay, spring hasn't arrived yet. All right, coming up, an Ottawa City Councillor who basically says Belleville has a great idea, launching an on-demand transit service for underused bus routes. Aren't they all underused right now? We'll discuss that with John Krupe and Chris Holsky on the other side. 919, News Talk 580, CFRA.
Ottawa at Work, Big Five Stories.
We continue to count down the Big Five Stories in and around our community. I have John Krupe from the CTV Ottawa Simonetter and Chris Holsky alongside this morning, of course, from our newsroom. All right, let's talk specifically about the fact that we are losing about $1 million a week here in Ottawa, running buses that no one is taking. Enter City Councillor Carol Ann Meehan, and she's pushing for the city to adopt a new transit model. How would it work? Well, like Uber. Bottom line here, it's a system designed to bring people from the suburbs to the city's core, but you would do it based on actual people using it and not just following the routes. Did I explain that right, Chris?
Yeah, essentially what happens is that during nighttime routes, people would book a time and a location for a bus to come by. It would get dumped into a computer system, and then they would map out a series of overnight routes based off of that, presumably to send somebody a notice of when exactly a bus is going to arrive in front of their doorstep to take them to their destination.
So a bus driver, for example, between 1 and 2 could do one route, more or less, and then between 2 and 3, when a new group of people are getting up and going to work, they would do another route.
Well, here's the thing. Instead of having this one continual loop of buses, you'd have like a customized route that a bus would go on instead of going the same time every time in a repetitive pattern for a while, even though they do kind of trade off. It's like the same routes are done over and over again by different drivers. You would have a bus going to different locations, adjusted locations to grab people and then take them to the place that they need to go.
So there'd be fewer buses on the road, fewer drivers necessary. What's next? Layoffs?
Well maybe. Right? Maybe. Well, the one thing I look at, right, is that this is being compared to a system that's being used in Belleville. And Belleville's system is very different from Ottawa. Their buses all run through a centralized station. All of their routes catch this station when they're out and about. The city's based on a bit of a grid. Ottawa, on the other hand, you're talking about this giant area that has far-off-reaching suburbs like your Kanata, your Stittsville, your Barrhaven. your Orleans instead of just one centralized area like Belleville. I'm not sure the feasibility of this is going to work. I think it's a question that's worth asking. I think it's worth getting a study on it. Keep in mind, though, a study is going to cost money to see if it's workable. But you could be looking at a scenario, say, where, okay, so somebody needs to be picked up at Jockdale in Barrhaven, and then somebody has to be picked up over closer to Fallowfield. And in between, the first person who gets onto this bus, it could be making stops all over Barrhaven, like east, west, north, south, until it finally gets to point number two and then takes people into the city from there. Does that not sound to you like somebody could be getting on a bus and instead of getting on their one single route, which takes 15 minutes to get to their next transfer point, they could be riding on a bus for like an hour, maybe, as you go from place to place? I'm not sure it would work.
The problem is it changes the whole idea of a public transit system because you don't know if the bus is going to show up or not if you need it once in a blue moon.
Well, you'd enter that data, so it should show up at a specific time for you, but that time may be, you know, an hour earlier than you would like it to be.
Kruppi, I'm confused. What do you think of the idea?
$6 billion. $6 billion we're spending on light rail, and this would undermine light rail in eventually. You know, the town of Innisfil uses Uber. There are 36,000 people, so they have no transit system. Should we use Uber in the suburbs? Well, maybe worth looking at. I wouldn't want to spend a lot of money on it. But OC Transpo, according to their website, carries, what, 350,000 people a day?
In a good year.
And yeah, well, those might come back, hopefully. The big chunk of that will come back. We're, you know, Belleville's population is 50,000. And Nepean's bigger, twice as big as Belleville. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. And for those people who think that, you know, maybe privatizing OC Transpo, you know, maybe in the suburbs is a possibility, forget that. There's no private transit systems in the world for municipalities. They don't work. They lose money.
Yeah, they lose money. It's part of the model, right? Because you are serving the public, and it's a cost you accept to bring people to your community.
Right now, there are plans already to build LRT out into the suburbs anyway, and even if people in the middle of the night, if they're within walking distance of a station or something, a little bit better option than that, even hopping on an Uber, I don't see it financially right now a scenario where the city looking at customized routes is one that's necessarily workable. I think it's worth asking the question. Maybe there's like an out there chance that this might be financially feasible here in Ottawa, but I don't see it. Somebody with better idea of how this would work needs to look at it.
Hey, John Kruppi, someone who watched the LRT from an idea to what it's become, is it a success in your books?
Well, the first line was a huge success. The second one, well, it was a success for about 3 months before the door started jamming.
Yeah.
They're lucky, so lucky we have this pandemic that they could fix these major problems. Who knows what kind of a winter we would have had, right?
Yeah.
Hopefully those major problems are fixed and the label of lemon can be removed from the system. We're going to need it, especially if we move back to normal business downtown, a vibrant downtown. Because as Chris said, we're heading to the suburbs. We're going to Trim Road and we're going to Moody Drive and then further afield, hopefully if we have money in a decade to come, two decades to come. So, you know, who would have thought 25 years ago that Ottawa would have an LRT system?
Yeah.
No one. And who would have thought we were going to the suburbs as far east as Trim Road? No one. So pretty good.
Yeah. Million people and growing every year. I mean, this is a place a lot of people are coming, and that's, you know, brings us to the next topic, which is red hot real estate, which we'll talk in the next hour about. John Kruppi, Chris Holsky, thank you, gentlemen. It's 9:30. We'll break for news. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
There's a sound of a song that sounds like it's spring, right? It sure feels like it. Good news, couple of days of warm temperatures, a tease of spring, and then it goes back to normal around 2 degrees on the weekend, just as time as we go to spring forward. So, hey, we're getting there, folks. Hang on. Have you been to the dentist during the pandemic? It's an interesting experience because I know a lot of people were nervous to do so for whatever reason other than that, of course, they're in your face, they're in your mouth, the work that they do, but they've taken all the precautions that they could at their disposal to be able to do it. But from the beginning, they say, we need to get on the vaccine priority list. Finally, they are, as I discussed with Dr. David Stevenson. He's the lead on the Ontario Working Group on Pandemic Protocol for Dentists.
Looks like you get started nice and early. You're in your scrubs already.
Yes.
Well, appreciate your time. All right. How hard was it to get on that list?
You know, at the end of last year, the Ontario Dental Association was advocating on behalf of dentists and their staff as well to make sure that the COVID vaccine task force was aware of what dentistry had to do in the environment that we work in and the risk that we put ourselves in, so that we would have priority access, not the highest priority access, but very high priority access to the vaccine. So I won't say it was difficult, because the province and the COVID vaccine task force, they obviously listened to us and understood our needs. So it wasn't difficult. And we're, quite frankly, I think it's appropriate where dentists and dentistry, our staff as well, are positioned. First and foremost, it had to go to the frontline workers in congregate care settings and hospitals. But now that it's out in the community healthcare workers, dentistry is important.
Yeah, and that's not to say that it's been unsafe for patients till now, though.
No, exactly. I would like to think this is just another element to add to the confidence that people have. I mean, this is good for dentistry, but it's also very good for our communities. You know, as a dentist, I see between 12 and 15 patients a day, and it's important. The Ministry of Health and the Chief Medical Officer of Health expects dentists and our staff to be open to treat patients, to keep them out of the hospitals, to keep them healthy. Because your dental health is so important to your overall health. And as dentists, we take that responsibility very seriously. It's a big expectation. We've taken extraordinary measures to make it safe. This is just another element to add to that safety.
Yeah, you and your staff are obviously in our mouths as a result. Were you worried that some people were afraid to come to the dentist because you weren't on that list till now?
You know, the pandemic has a very important effect and a very profound impact on everybody. And as I mentioned earlier, I know there's been some people that have been hesitant to come to the dentist. Hopefully this will just add to their confidence. Again, dentists, our staff, we have taken extraordinary measures to make it safe. This is just like adding another layer. And I think this is very important.
For the lead of the Ontario Pandemic Recovery Working Group, I'm wondering if there is someone who works in a dental office who's watching right now. How are they going to prove it if they don't have the DDS after their name?
Leslie, I'm not sure I understand your question.
So
how are they going to prove it?
If you're a hygienist, if you're a staff member of a dental, when you go to the vaccination clinic, how do you get on that list and say, hey, I'm not a dentist, but I work with one, and prove it? Because that's an issue right now for a lot of...
Yeah. Dentaling, yeah. Well, I practice in Leeds, Grenville, Lanark, and so I received my notice to get a vaccine last week. And essentially, each office is given a code, and then we as an office will give that code to our staff. So it was booked online, so it's very structured. And then when I went, they asked for my credentials. Sometimes every different neighborhood or every different public health unit may have something different. They may require a pay stub or a letter from your employer that says, ask if you were a staff member. The regulated health professions, so hygienists and dentists, of course, they have their registration for their college that they can bring. But every health unit is different, so make sure that when you get that notice to book your appointment, that you ask and make sure you know exactly what it is you're supposed to bring to the appointment for credentials.
And how soon will everybody be done? Do we know?
I'm just so very grateful. Like, this is a good step forward, that we're now in the very high priority working group. You know, the Prime Minister has said he wants everybody done by the end of the summer. It's certainly looking like the vaccine supplies are improving that. Every different region will be different. And I know on the show earlier, you even mentioned that sometimes neighborhoods could have a different timeline because they have to have that flexibility to prioritize just what's happening in their own region. But I think this is moving very quickly and very soon. I would never want to pin a date on it, though. Never want to pin a date.
Dr. David Stevenson, thank you. Appreciate it for your time.
You're very
this morning.
Well, Leslie. Glad to be here.
The takeaway, of course, is if you had any hesitation about going to the dentist because of the potential risks for you, first of all, there is no case of actual transmission of COVID because of the precautions they take every day. And we've seen full offices for a long time. But now that's going to change even more so, maybe even more protected for you when those shots roll out at dentists, well, right across the province. You know, let's face it, the world came to a halt initially, including, you know, for a while there, the dental office routine. We're now looking back at 2020 and say it was really a year like no other. Now, imagine living in the United States where you not only had the pandemic, but you had a historic U.S. election. There's a producer slash comedian, because he's a comedian first, but he's become a producer of television shows by the name of Connor Malbouf. He actually is a Canadian who lived in Los Angeles, found himself there in the middle of a pandemic, and watched history all around him. And spontaneity kicked in one day, and he said, I need to document this. So he has now created a documentary film. It's called 1 Week Till Doomsday. He's just finished the final edit, and I spoke to the producer, Connor Malbuff, earlier today.
This is quite the project. I see the smile. I mean, this is, I mean, spontaneity at its best, and you walk away with a project you can be proud of. How did it come about?
I mean, really, I was in LA, COVID hit, I was unemployed. I said to myself, what is going to be a meaningful project that'll get people talking? As a Canadian, I thought it was an interesting perspective. Get four immigrants in a van, drive across the country and talk to Americans before the biggest election in modern day history. And it turned into something we couldn't even have imagined. So yeah, it was fantastic.
You know, there's that old expression, it's like something out of central casting. I mean, you could not have planned the characters better than what you found.
I mean, we literally talked to you people from all walks of life. As you saw in the trailer, we have Trump side, QAnon, Joe Biden supporters, choir members, you know, every walk of life. Yeah, drag queens in the smallest town in Texas, and some pretty heavy hitting interviews as well. It was great.
And what did you find out about America?
That it's deeply, deeply divided, even more than we think. And maybe because I'm a Canadian, I understood the division better or saw it from a different lens because I wasn't actually, you know, fully invested. You know, I don't even vote in this country. So I didn't have stakes per se in the game, which allowed me to have better conversations with those people. And I mean, America is more divided than I ever thought. And it definitely shows in the documentary.
You know, a lot of people say there are two Americas. I'm imagining there's more than two now that you've probably documented there.
I mean, I think there's up to 15, if you're going to be completely honest.
Yeah.
There are so many little facets into all of these little communities where, like, towns that don't even have a post office. I mean, it was really talking to people on the ground before they made this pivotal decision. And it's about humanity, you know? It's about humanity in the discovering of humans and as people. And it turned out to be something completely different than we thought.
Well, you had two big topics. I mean, you had a pandemic and you had Trump at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, the pandemic didn't help. Also, you're trying to get tested in towns because as we go through 15 states, you try to keep the testing regime up. But you're in towns that don't even have testing facilities. So that brought forward another problem where it really showcased the problem with the healthcare system in this country. Because as a Canadian, I'm so fortunate to understand, you know, I bring my OHIP card, I go to the doctors and kind of just like that. And a lot of these towns, it's very hard to just get basic healthcare.
It'll make you laugh. It'll make you think, maybe even cry at some points. What did it do for you?
I mean, I cried so much more than I anticipated. I'm a comedian. I've toured with Nikki Glaser and I've done some, you know, more so on the comedic side, a lot of improv. And then going on to this, I saw myself finding such deep, deep roots that are, it was so sad. I would be in the car in our Dodge Caravan after some interviews, just bawling my eyes out because these stories were so not only inspiring, but just heart-wrenching, right? You know, one of the stories that sticks out to me was a young man who was homeless, a drug addict on the street, who partnered up with Mike Tyson, was found during the Boston Marathons and created an Oklahoma marijuana farm for incarcerated youth that have formerly been accused of drug charges. So there are stories like that that are just so uplifting and make, you know, you realize that there is still humanity in this divided world, right?
Connor, when can we see it?
We have a release date right now for summer 2021. Of course, it's in the festival market, so things could change. But you can head over to oneweektilldoomsday.com to keep up to date with all the release date information.
What's next for Connor?
That's a good question. I'd like to get back in the stand-up world, but right now in LA, it's pretty not much going on. So, yeah. I mean, who knows what will happen with this? I can't wait to see, you know, its reactions in the film festival market and see what happens with this film because it is the epitome and perfect time capsule for this moment in history. Whether you're a Canadian, American, you're going to take something away from it that is beautiful, and I can't wait for people to see it.
You'll be thinking and you'll be entertained at the same time. It's amazing how life sometimes throws us a curveball in what you can produce. Connor Malbuff, best of luck. We're looking forward to the ongoing projects. In the meantime, 1 week till Doomsday, coming soon to a theater near you, we hope. Thank you. Appreciate it, Connor.
All right, coming up, you now know if you have a previous existing medical condition. You move up in the vaccine line. Should you have to prove it to get the shot in the arm? We'll discuss the pros and cons of that. More importantly, how do you prove it? Do you bring your puffer if you're an asthmatic? We'll discuss it next. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
I don't know about you, but there are people in my family, in my circle of friends, who have what would be described as a pre-existing health condition. And that's the people I worry most about when we go through this pandemic, protecting them until they get the shot in the arm. We know that they've been moved up ahead of a lot of healthy people in terms of not having pre-existing medical conditions to getting the shot in the arm. And we're learning now that, hey, they won't be asked to provide proof that the pre-existing health condition is even there to get that vaccine. Health Minister Christine Elliott said she believes most people will come to clinics when they are permitted and not take advantage of the honor system. Is that being a little naive and a little too Canadian? Or is that a good idea? I mean, the honor system is pretty important, right? And through this pandemic, we've, for the most part, seen it work. But this is something where it's really a matter of life and death for some people. And we're seeing also the impatience, the frustrations boiling over for many that maybe the honor system will go the way of the dodo. I know my next guest is worried about that. We welcome back Dr. Michael Warner, Medical Director, Critical Care, Toronto's Michael Garron Hospital. Thanks for taking some of your busy day with us this morning.
Thanks for having me back.
Queue jumping is inevitable is how way you're predicting it, right?
100%. I mean, we've seen it just when there's been different public health restrictions across arbitrary borders in the GTA. People travel to where they can do more things. And this time we're not talking about lining up for concert tickets, Leslie. We're talking about getting a life-saving vaccine that also could confer quite a bit more freedom for people. And we have a phase two list of eligible conditions that includes 24 conditions, which will likely cover 4 to 5 million people. And, you know, it's not just queue jumping. It's how do we triage people within those groups? Like, Leslie, what does respiratory diseases mean? What does heart disease mean? All cancers. This is why we need family doctors to be triaging their patients to determine those who are at most risk to get their vaccine first and make sure we have carve-outs for those without a family physician. Excluding family doctors is really to the detriment of this entire vaccination effort and will lead to more lives lost.
When you put a tweet out yesterday, it kind of summed it up all for me. Even within protocol, an 18-year-old with mild asthma is the same priority as a 55-year-old on home oxygen for emphysema because, as you mentioned, what is a respiratory disease? They both fall under that title.
And this isn't necessarily about blaming people, because if you are that 18-year-old with asthma, you don't know that that you may be taking the spot of the 55-year-old with emphysema who can't get to the vaccination center because you're included as per the criteria. So it's not necessarily about people being bad. There will always be bad actors who want to get things ahead of other people, but there's no clarity. I mean, coming out with a PowerPoint deck on a Friday saying this is our phase two plan and actually executing the plan and having details that make it actionable are two different things. I think the government is improvising here, and we don't have an actual plan.
Are you surprised, given the history? And I've spoken to you about the frustrations you have the way that government has handled things to date.
Well, Leslie, I only put out videos on Twitter when I'm really ticked off. And you know, this time, it's about life or death. Mm. You know, when it was about crossing borders to get a haircut, you could say that could increase COVID risk. But these vaccines are so effective. We've seen this in long-term care, that the people who are at most risk for dying, also at highest risk for being exposed to COVID and subsequently dying, need to get these first. And if they don't, because we have limited supply at this point, that will lead to lives lost. Once we have limitless supply, it just becomes a speed game. You need to get as many jabs in arms as possible, and the order doesn't matter as much. But at this stage, this pivotal stage, when ICU numbers are up, we admitted 27 patients overnight with COVID-19. We're up to 344 in the province. Wave 3 is coming. The numbers will continue to rise. People have more freedom because of the change in restrictions. This is a critical time, these next 2 months. We can't afford to screw it up.
So you're back to the idea you have for family doctors. Every doctor knows the condition of all their patients. Therefore, they would be the ones to prioritize, let's say, the top 10 conditions from worst to best, right?
They have a great sense of the overall frailty of their patients, their ability to access the internet to book an appointment, their ability to get to an appointment, their exposure risk. Which of these conditions? Some people might have 10 of these conditions. They're the ones, and furthermore, Leslie, family doctors provide vaccinations every year for influenza and other diseases. This is their core competency. How could we exclude them? Why are we trying to reinvent the wheel and create a whole new process that isn't even up and running? I mean, where is this provincial website? It's not ready yet, which is why many public health jurisdictions and hospitals are just going on without the province and leaving them behind.
There's a shift in conversation right now, especially in the media, where people are looking forward to the light at the end of the tunnel. Suddenly, it seems like it's at our door. And I know you're over here waving your hand saying, wait a minute, folks, we're not out of the woods yet. Meanwhile, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in the States, has new guidelines when it comes to, fully vaccinated people. 2 weeks past their final shot, if you're in the States, you can visit indoors with unvaccinated members of a single household without wearing masks or even social distancing. Is that a recipe for disaster?
I think time will tell. I'm not sure. I mean, we don't know what variants could be in the future. We don't know whether the vaccines we have will be an antidote to everything that's coming. I'd say that we're actually quite behind the United States in that we're not even close to that point yet. And the narrative coming out of vaccination centers and people get their vaccine is saying, I'm ready to go hug my grandparents. Mm-hmm. That's really important, but I don't think that's where we're at right now. We're trying to save the most lives. We're still having to adhere to public health advice. We've started running the marathon. We haven't finished it, and we don't know what our time is. So we shouldn't act like the race is over. We still need to focus, really focus the next 2 months, because we are close.
Yeah.
And it will be better. But if we jump the gun, we just won't be doing it properly, and we need to make sure those, especially in hot zone areas, get vaccinated earlier than those who are at much less risk of being exposed to COVID.
How do you feel about the Toronto area you are and the reopening that they've launched?
Well, I mean, it doesn't make sense to increase the ability for people to interact at a time where cases are surely rising. I mean, we're moving patients all across the GTA with COVID every day now because hospitals have exceeding capacity.
Huh.
There's more patients in single hospitals in Toronto with COVID-19 than there are in all of Ottawa, which is a completely different city and a completely different situation. Toronto needs more vaccination on a per capita basis because we have more healthcare workers, more at-risk people, higher concentration of people living in congregate settings. And if Toronto and Peel do better, the whole province moves ahead. And we should all try and move ahead at the same time instead of areas that are hardest hit being left behind because of the political equitable distribution of vaccines, which doesn't make sense epidemiologically.
Well, that's a reality check for sure. Dr. Warner, thank you for your time as always.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Warner, Medical Director, Critical Care at Toronto's Michael Guerin Hospital. We're going to break for news on the other side. Things are changing in real estate in Ottawa. How so? We'll tell you. Next, News Talk 580 CFRA.
At Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Stop me if you've heard this before. There has never been a more intense housing market in Ottawa than there is today. Yeah, that theme has been around, for months, if not a year now, despite the pandemic. Prices are through the roof. Which is good news if you're a seller, but not so much if you're a buyer, as we know. There's a theme, right, that has been developing, and it seems to be more and more intense. Well, enter the time of the year now when people decide spring is here, I'm going to list my house. Therefore, the issue of supply and demand could change. Is it happening yet? What's it like right now? Well, our guy in the know, of course, Frank Napolitano, Mortgage Brokers Ottawa, mortgage agent, host of Open House, the Real Estate Mortgage Show on this very station. Hey, Frank.
Hey, good morning.
Hey, what's the very latest? Are we seeing more supply coming?
A little bit more supply. Listings are up, according to a couple of the realtors that I've chatted with. And interestingly enough, I've had also a couple of realtors say that on a couple of their listings, what they've done is they've decided instead of listing for, that lower price and then having oodles of people go through it and then accepting an offer 4 or 5 days from now, what they're doing is they're putting the top price that the seller wants, and first come, first serve. Whoever makes that offer that they're happy with, they're going to go with. So the traditional way.
What changed?
Of selling a house.
What changed? Is it stopped working for them?
Well, what I think is happening, and a couple of the realtors that I spoke with said that what's happening is some people are just foregoing the buying. I mean, they're saying, forget it. I don't want to get into a scenario where we get heartbroken because we put an offer in $50,000 over list and we're not even in the top five. Like, we're not in, you know, once you've gone through it four, five, six times, it's disheartening. So, some realtors have decided to change that a little bit and just say, tell me what the top number you would go for and let's just list it for that amount. And then, you know, people come to see it, and then they know, they'll see right on the listing that there's no, we're taking offers on this date. It's like, nope, you go see it, and if you like it, you make an offer, and if they accept it, they accept it. So much more feasible for people that have been turned off by the whole process of having to pay, overpay or feel like they're overpaying for a property.
Will this make it more affordable now for people?
I don't know. I think the list price is still probably, but the list price might be on the high end of what they think the property's worth. Maybe it should be a little lower, but they're listing a little higher. But that was the way it used to be anyway. I mean, people would always think their house was worth more. And then a realtor would, you know, after 2 weeks, if you don't get an offer, I think we got to lower the price a little bit. That's the traditional way of the way real estate was sold. And it's just changed over the last year, 18 months to do this. But maybe we're going to see it getting back to the other, you know, to the way it always was. Nothing wrong with that, I don't think.
So this is kind of like a rebellion by buyers who are fed up with being disappointed. And then in some cases, how many offers, what was the most number of offers you had on one property that you dealt with?
Well, I've had a couple of clients tell me they've had over 40 offers. And that's just absurd. I mean, that's crazy when you've got that many people looking to buy a house. I mean, that if that's not definition of supply and demand issues, nothing else, you know, nothing else is.
So now the question I always ask you this, is now the time to list if things are changing and you want top dollar?
Well, traditionally the spring is when most people want to sell their homes because if they're changing neighborhoods, they're setting themselves up to get their kids set up for a new school. And, you know, the feeling is that we'll be back to normal in September and kids will be going back to school and it won't be the online learning, you know, if everybody's vaccinated. So traditionally, this is the time that, you know, people, and with the beautiful weather coming, you know, approaching us in the next couple of days, this is when people go out and look at homes and go to open houses on the weekends. And so, you know, do I think, again, I mean, if the listings continue to go up, then I think some of the craziness should temper itself.
So, for example, an offer without conditions, now you can ask for an inspection, that kind of stuff?
I think we'll see that come back. I don't know that we're quite there yet at this point, but I think over the next few months, I expect that we'll start to see normalcy kick back in and, you know, somebody putting an offer on a property and having 5 days to get their financing and home inspection in place wouldn't be out of the question. And it would be nice for the buyers because that's a lot of stress for buyers to go through like they're doing right now.
Yeah. The policymakers, the Bank of Canada and so on, mortgage, you know, rates and so on, nothing is going to change as a result, is it?
Well, they're caught. They're kind of caught on both sides. So from one end, I mean, you know, they know the housing market has been overheated. So for them to make it easier to get mortgages, they don't know that they want to take that step because it's already overheated to begin with. But the flip side of that is that right now, the way the rules are and the stress test being that somebody has to qualify at 4.79%, it's taking away the opportunity for some young Canadians to get into home ownership, or even middle-class Canadians are having a hard time getting a mortgage in some city centers. So, you know, they're caught between a rock and a hard place right now, what to do. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see any changes over the next 3, 4, 5 months. It sounds like the budget's been delayed. That might be part of the budget. Obviously, there's an election coming, so they might make some changes, you know, from an election standpoint. But, you know, for now, I mean, we'd like to see the stress test rate lowered a little bit. That being said, you know, fixed rates have started to climb a little bit. We had an increase about 2 weeks ago. I think this week the bond market's gone up a little bit more. We'll see a little increase this week because the banks really, really act quickly when bond markets go up. So TD Bank announced yesterday that they were going to raise their fixed rates another 10 basis points.
What does that mean?
We're still in the low twos. Okay. So, you know, nothing wrong. I mean, we're not where we were a month ago, but, you know, the rates are still fantastic.
Co-signers, are we seeing more and more because, the young, as you mentioned, first-time buyers, you know, young couples, that's becoming an issue more and more?
We're seeing guarantors and co-signers. Okay. So some banks don't allow guarantors. They want a parent to go on as a co-signer. In the mortgage broker industry, we have good lenders that will allow for the parents to go on as guarantors. And the big thing with the guarantors is that their name is not on title, and their name is technically not on the mortgage either. They're just guarantors, and what happens is if, you know, in the event that there's a delinquency in place, the bank or lender will call the guarantor and explain to them what's going on. And at that point, the guarantor can either bring the payments up to date or refuse to. And if they refuse to, and then the lender has to take over the house, the lender will only go after them if they lose money.
Okay.
But in this market, it doesn't appear like they're going to lose any money.
The asset's solid and growing.
Yeah, the asset's pretty good. So, you know, the other thing that we're seeing, which is really interesting, is New Zealand. It's only 3 weeks old, but they, you know, talk about some policy-making changes that they made. They were having the same issues that we're having here in Canada. And what they've done is they've decided that if you're going to be an investor and you're buying a property that you're not going to be living in, you must put 40% down payment.
Whew.
So what they're trying to do is deter investors and leave the housing market open for people that are actually going to own or occupy property. So it's too early to tell how successful and or whether it's going to be a failure. But by all accounts, it seems like it's not a bad idea, so that because they have a problem where they've got too many people that are renting that want to be homeowners, and the investors are driving the prices up. So they're trying to calm that down a little bit.
There was talk about taxing potentially the profits on your primary residence, which are tax-free now if you live in it longer than a year. Has that gone away?
I think it's gone away, and I think that most will then say, well, if you're going to tax us for making a profit, then let us write off the interest.
Right.
Have like the interest as a write-off. Like you shouldn't have it both ways. So,
right.
You know, I don't think that's going to come back, especially with an election. I think that that would be
not a good plan.
Yeah.
You'd lose a lot of votes, guaranteed. Especially in some of the urban areas if you're a Liberal, because that's where they seem to dominate in cities like Toronto and Montreal and Vancouver. The other thing I've heard about, I don't know if you've heard this, is that friends of mine who couldn't afford a first house, their parents actually said, rather than give you, you know, what would be your inheritance, and it's, you know, not a large amount, but it was enough to help with the down payment, and they gave it to them now in advance.
Yeah, living inheritances are becoming a big thing right now. You know what? I think it's fantastic. I can tell you, I'm certainly one of those that I want to see my kids enjoy it. I don't want them to get it when I'm gone. I'd like to, you know, if I've got money that I want to give them, why not give it to them now and watch, you know, either my kids and eventually my grandkids enjoy some of it. So I think we're seeing a lot of it. I think parents are gifting. You know, it used to be that they were quote-unquote gifting their kids money, but they want it back at some point. Now everything I'm hearing is like, no, I want to help my kids get a head start on life, so I'm going to give them $50,000 to help them with the down payment for a house. So,
which is no problem, right, in terms of taxes or the banks don't take it in a negative way. It's all positive. Money's money.
Not at all.
Good.
Money is money. You know what? I mean, you can gift your family members, and there shouldn't be any tax implications. Boy, if that starts to happen, that'll be another outcry in itself.
I know.
So,
I always like to talk to you about some of the deals that are being done. Anything jumps out at you this week?
Still, you know what? I will say that some of the numbers that I've heard aren't as crazy as I've been hearing. So that also, you know, leads me to believe that things are starting to calm down a little bit. That being said, I mean, there's still some properties out there that are going way over list. Crazy numbers of property listed at 589 that sold for 695. I mean, that's significant. In my eyes, it's not as crazy as some of the other ones we've seen, but it's still significant. I mean, that's a big jump to go from, you know, one number, what you can afford and what the payment. Now, again, on $100,000, I mean, you're talking about $300 a month, $350 a month.
Which people can afford, right? They just don't look at the big picture. You got an extra $100,000, you know, for 20 years to pay off type thing.
You got it. It's not as shattering, but still, it's still big enough. I mean, it's a big enough number there. So, you know, the thing that people got to be wary of is, unfortunately, the MPAC got delayed by a year, and the MPAC assessments are going to be coming out this coming November and December, and they're going to be using the values of 2021 instead of the values of 2020. So, be prepared for quite a hike in your property taxes come next year.
We shouldn't be surprised. We really shouldn't.
No,
we're not going to like it, but you know, you're benefiting, and therefore you got to pay the price in holding on to that asset in the form of property taxes.
People have a lot more equity than they ever imagined they would. That's, you know, whether you bought your house 10 years ago or whether you bought your house 2 years ago, the equity that you've accumulated in your home is unbelievable over the last 18 months.
In April, which is traditionally a hot spot for you know, buyers and sellers, unusually so this year, we've had a booming winter. Do you think more supply and more buyers will come onto the market next month and maybe return to the hots, or are we going to continue the the way we are, cooling down slowly but surely now?
Well, the buyers are there, right? The problem with this whole market is that the buyers have been there and the sellers haven't been there. So as inventory goes up, I mean, the thinking isn't that there's going to be any more buyers. The thinking is that the buyers that have been on the sidelines and haven't been able to get homes hopefully will now have access to homes, which should temper down a little bit the craziness that we've seen over the last 6 to 8 months. But and January, February specifically have been the craziest of the 2 months. That's what's been nuts about it is it was hot in the summer, it was hot in the fall, beginning of winter, but January, February are just another level in itself so far. And so far, March has seemed to get back a little bit more normal so far. But we'll see when the numbers come out. So many million-dollar homes sold, and that's why the numbers are as high as they are over the last 2 months as well.
Yeah, brand new, list of homes over a million. That's remarkable in such a short period of time. Thank you, Frank. Great insight as always.
Pleasure. And again, yep, support local businesses and charities, everyone.
Always with that important message. Thank you, Frank. Frank Napolitano, mortgage agent. Of course, you know the show, Open House, the real estate mortgage show on the weekends. Coming up, we rank worse than most developed countries in the misery index. Are we a bunch of complainers, or is there reason to complain? We'll find out on the other side. News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580, CFRA.
Well, this is a headline that grabs your attention. Canada ranks worse than most developed countries in COVID-19 Misery Index. Yeah, said index suggests that overall well-being in Canada has suffered more than average in pandemic. We rank 11th out of 15 countries on a scale of miserableness. Didn't know there was such a scale. But there is, as our friends at the McDonnell Laurier Institute know. Brett Byers, Communications and Digital Media Manager for McDonnell Laurier Institute. Good morning, Brett. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you for having me.
It's not all bad news, though, is it?
No, it's not all bad news for Canada. Canada's actually performed above average in terms of battling the disease. So on some of the measures that we looked at, things like excess mortality for those aged 85 plus, the number of cases that we've had, ICU admissions, et cetera, Canada's actually performed well above average. It's when we start getting into other kinds of issues, such as our vaccination rates, testings, the strictness of our lockdowns and how long our lockdowns have lasted, as well as kind of the economic impact, that Canada runs into a little bit more trouble.
The last one we could be paying for many generations, potentially, for the checks that were written during all of this. Is that specifically that last one?
Right, that's correct. So the two worst measures that we tracked on the misery index for Canada, one was debt in terms of the debt incurred and what our projected debt is going to look like into the future. Now, again, this is far worse than the average country. Even, particularly countries that did battle the disease better were able to do so without incurring the quite significant costs that we did.
Yeah.
And the other issue that we really face, too, is a pretty terrible unemployment situation. Mm-hmm. In fact, of the 15 countries measured, including Canada, we have the worst misery score for unemployment.
Meaning what? Like, how does that transfer into numbers? Or is it attitudes?
So a misery index comes from economics. Specifically, the first misery index looked at both unemployment and inflation, and used those two measures to determine how human well-being in the economy is generally affected. So with our misery index, it's a lot more complex. We take 16 indicators across three major categories that cover the disease, our response to it, and the economic impact. And taking those categories and looking at them a lot more closely, we're able to pull out indicators like what is the change in unemployment been, and extrapolating from that, developing a score against an average of other countries to determine how that might impact the well-being of individuals in a society.
Who did better than we? Who's at the top?
So Norway's at the top. And, Norway is, oftentimes competing with us for things like human development scores and other kinds of indices. But in particular, when it came to battling COVID-19, they fought it very efficiently. They were able to protect human health and the economy by having a quite substantial sovereign wealth fund as well. They did not have the same kind of economic consequences, that Canada suffered. Other countries that beat us include New Zealand, Australia, Sweden, Japan, Germany. So we're you know, 11 out of 15 is not a place where Canada really wants to be, in the bottom 30% of the countries that we measured.
Yeah.
But hopefully as vaccines roll out, our score might improve.
Just to feel better, who's worse than we are?
Worse than us are Italy, France, the UK, and Spain.
Where it was hit hard, right? They got huge COVID numbers and terrible, you know, economic issues too.
That's precisely right. Countries that were hit extremely hard by the virus tended to also have poor responses and tended to have poor economic outcomes. Canada is actually a bit of an outlier in this regard. Among the kind of countries in our peer group, we've done very well on the disease front itself, but we've just done much more poorly on the economic and COVID side than most other countries that are kind of our neighbors on this misery index.
You know, we keep talking about the way Israel has been handling it. We, you know, number one when it comes to vaccine rollout. Are they even in the misery index at all?
So we didn't include Israel. Yeah. And the reason why is that we're looking specifically for our closest peer countries.
Got it.
So the countries that we picked were the countries that inform the price review for medicines in Canada, as well as countries in the Commonwealth. So these are countries which our healthcare system itself kind of identifies as peers.
And the U.S. at all?
Yes, the U.S. is above us. It's two ranks above us on the index. They perform much more poorly on the disease side, again, having much higher cases, mm-hmm. much higher deaths per capita, those sorts of things. But they did perform better with respect to their response, and that's largely driven by the fact that they're crushing it on vaccines.
Yeah, I was going to say, that really brought them up, I'm sure.
It absolutely did.
In the last quarter.
So basically the light is at the end of the tunnel for the U.S., whereas Canada, you know, while vaccine rollout is picking up, there's news today that we could be seeing another wave in places like Toronto and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. There's some concern that, you know, Ottawa might go back into a red zone. So with those kinds of concerns looming and the possibility that the, you know, restrictions and misery therein could be continued, it's important to, you know, put aside our usual Canadian smugness that we're better than the United States at all things and consider how, with respect particularly to vaccines, we might learn a lesson or two from their approach.
Well said. Brett, thank you. Appreciate it. Very interesting.
No problem. Thanks so much for having me, Leslie.
Brett Byers, Communications Digital Media Manager, full of information there from the McDonnell Laurier Institute. 10:31, let's break for news. News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580, CFRA.
All right, I want to throw some numbers at you here. 500,000 women remain unemployed in Canada amid the pandemic. 500,000. There are 838,000 fewer jobs overall. Do the math there. Here's the added part. Women are not only bearing the brunt of job losses, they weren't earning as much to begin with, right? So here's the question. Will this all correct itself when we get back to normal? Let's try and answer this. Liz Betsis, economist with the Labor Market Information Council. Good morning. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much for having me here.
I think bottom line here, people aren't surprised because it's been making headlines throughout the pandemic that women are harder hit than men. Now, as we look forward, do we need to pivot and emphasize the necessity to help women more than men back to the job market?
I think the data really shows the vulnerabilities that women encounter during COVID-19, especially low-earning women and working mothers. And as we move forward to a sustainable and equitable recovery, we really need to keep those factors in mind.
Yeah. So, for example, I know that it's just a statement on society in general right now. When jobs started getting lost and we had to make a choice as parents, the mom stayed at home with the kids in during this pandemic, and the numbers kind of played out. Not always, but just more times than not. Often, as you mentioned, women were hit in terms they got the job loss first because of the nature of the work that they do, given that the equities were already an issue going into the pandemic, or inequities, more importantly. So how do we do that? Is it a financial incentive? Is it what are some of the solutions we should be looking at now so we can plan for this?
The some of the facts that you mentioned about, women, working mothers staying more at home, and even mothers that, you know, remained employed took increasingly more leave, especially compared to men. 24% increased in leave for women, while only 3% for men. And we don't even know what kind of other implications might have been in terms of mental health and job progression from the things that are currently happening. So I think definitely a lot of the conversation surrounding childcare is important, but childcare alone wouldn't solve the issues currently happening. Mm-hmm. You know, businesses have adjusted to, you know, the decrease in labor and to the social distancing. And as we recover, a lot of the jobs that existed will no longer exist. So providing opportunities for reskilling and upskilling for everyone, but especially for low-earning women, I think will prove to be very useful. So, going forward, we also know women are underrepresented in the telecommutable jobs. So increasing their opportunities there, I think, would be very important.
So how do we do that? And you know, I hate to use the word fair, but how do we do this to attract them and be fair so that it isn't, you know, or should we say we've got 12 spots to fill, we want 10 women, and we have opening for 2 men? How far should we go?
Right, and that's the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah.
As a labor market expert myself, what I really do is deal with the data and see where the opportunities are and what the vulnerabilities are and where we can inform policy. And at LMIC, we will continue to monitor the recovery. We look forward to the LFS release coming in the next several days and to see what's really happening in real time and you know, help policymakers make data-informed decisions that are really at, you know, the core of what's going on.
Well, let me ask you, do you have faith that we're going to get it right, or we need to be prodded?
I'd like to have faith. I think it's always good to be positive, and especially, you know, we've seen a lot of reports coming out yesterday for International Women's Day, so the conversation is definitely going. It's not only LMIC, but it's been a pleasure to be at the forefront of, you know, making this conversation. So I think really awareness and people's willingness and policymakers' willingness has been good, and you know, that shines a light on on the situation.
Is there anything, you know, the women at home or the women affected by what we've just discussed about, maybe listening, should be doing to make change?
That is a really good question, Leslie. I mean, LMIC does provide a lot of resources on the future of work that are very available on our website that can really help inform, you know, where things are going and potentially help make decisions with that respect. And we have a lot of data-driven projects coming up that will hopefully help career practitioners help everyone and, you know, women that have been impacted by COVID, you know, with the future of work and all of these things. But definitely, you know, keeping in mind that change is happening and we should respond to it.
I think the best thing you said is that you have data on there on where you think the movement and the growth will come. So what sectors are we talking about here potentially?
So we have a lot of resources about the future of work, about the kind of trends that are going on in general, about automation. We have all of the information. We have a section in our website that is dedicated all to the future of work, and it summarizes basically all of the cutting-edge research in the field in a way that is very accessible to everyone. We ourselves really like to analyze the data and you know, inform what comes from the data rather than make projection.
Got it.
But everything is very well summarized in very clear language, so everybody can be informed.
Yeah, knowledge is power. So you can inform yourself by. And what is your website at the Labor Market Information Council?
So it's LMIC-CIMT.ca.
Perfect. Liz, appreciate it. Really interesting. And I threw some questions at you knowing that a lot of it was speculation based on personal opinion. But I think that we need to have these frank discussions right now because it's great to say hey, this is the problem. But we need also, and you guys are providing obviously the data, but we also need to say, okay, where are the solutions? Because I don't know about you, but I haven't heard very many.
I understand that, Leslie, and I do agree that you know, solutions are imminent, and
yeah.
And I really hope that our local and provincial and federal governments will take the data and come up with equitable and sustainable solutions.
Challenge made right there. Appreciate it. Thank you, Liz Betsis. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Economist with the Labor Market Information Council. We'll take a break. Coming up, changing gears. We're going to count down the 30 greatest female singers of all time, ranked owner purely on vocal ability. There'll be some surprises in the list, especially in the top 10. And also, summer music festivals in Canada. We're all supposed to be vaccinated with our first shot by July 1st. Can any of those festivals, big or small, go ahead? We'll discuss that on the other side. News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580, CFRA.
Taylor Swift? Really? PJ, I asked her, we're going to count down the 30 greatest female singers of all time, and Taylor was your choice?
She's the greatest in my mind.
She is, even with that old school song?
Yeah, I love that one. Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with the old school, but unfortunately, if I were to say it's in pure vocal ability, the top 30. Do you think she would make it on there?
I think she'd be in the top 30 for sure.
She's not.
What? That surprises
me. It surprised me too. I went through it. We're going to count down and, I mean, let's face it. Taylor is a brand to herself and has massive appeal, selling a lot of records. But let's bring in the music expert in Canada, Eric Alper. Is it wrong to leave Taylor off this top 30 list, in your opinion, Eric? Good morning.
I think if you want to become a trending topic on Twitter and get a lot of hate mail, yeah, then you leave her off the list. But I think that's the right decision. I think she's amazing. You and I have certainly spent hours on this very radio program talking about the brilliance of her. So no slight to her. But no, she doesn't. I don't think she makes it. I think there are a lot of other women that I would even think of first. Even in the first hour of thinking about it, yeah.
PJ's not happy. Put a boo on there. All right.
Look, I think she's amazing. I think her last two albums, three albums, four albums were some of the best in music history. But I think that in terms of vocal ability, I don't think we've heard it. That's all.
So it is all pure vocal ability. As I look at the countdown of 30, we're going to go through them, and I'm going to stop where I think they don't belong. If you want me to stop for you, let me know. So number 30 is Kate Bush. Number 29, Carole King. One of the best albums ever. Number 28, Dusty Springfield? Question mark?
Yeah, she should be higher.
Okay.
I think her voice is one of, you know, this planet's most gorgeous, lush, harmonic sounds ever. And I think that she allowed her voice to bring country music to people who wouldn't otherwise like country music. Okay. Yeah, I would put her higher. Yeah,
Number 27, because we're counting, you know, from 30 to 1. Cher?
Yeah. Interesting about Cher, though, because her popularity of the last 20, 30 years was kind of solely based on that song, Believe.
Auto-tune.
And then she does ABBA covers, which aren't, you know, the most vocal gymnastic song to do.
Yeah.
So that was a curious choice, but certainly I think for about 10 or 15 years, she was definitely at the top of most people's list for, you know, most beloved singer during her TV show in the 70s.
Taylor Swift is to PJ what Madonna is to me, but I wouldn't put her on this list either. She's 26.
Yeah, Madonna, you know, doesn't, I think, being able to have the range because she sings so much pop and electronic dance music.
Yeah.
But I think that she could probably belt it out when she wants to.
Okay. Joni Mitchell? You can't argue.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't argue with that.
Dolly Parton? Can't argue that. Yeah. Right? Diana Ross.
Now, this is when you start to get into the argument, because people that were around during the Motown era would say that she might just be one of the greatest singers in music history.
Huh.
But again, I think that she, because she hasn't really done anything of the last 20, 25 years, I think that harms her standing just a little bit.
The other issue, too, is I don't think they used female vocals to the way they do now, right? They were used more to the beat as opposed to showcase the power, right?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, if you had if you've got the ability to put Diana Ross and make her trill like Christina Aguilera did, yeah, she can blow anybody to shame.
Donna Summer ahead of Diana Ross. We forget that she had all those disco hits, but she had a great voice.
Yeah, and, you know, was one of the only few people to actually have a 18-minute musical orgasm in the actual song for Love to Love You, Baby, which, you know, I think for that alone puts her in the top 25.
All right, next up, no comment, Stevie Nicks. She broke away, of course, from Fleetwood Mac, became a powerhouse, and really changed, I think, you know better than I do, but the landscape for female vocalists in that day.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Adele, modern day voice of the goddess.
I would have put her at number four.
Okay.
I would have easily put her in my top five. Yeah,
wow.
There's nothing that Adele can't do. Not only is she one of the biggest selling artists in music history, but the most critically acclaimed. And I think that that says a lot, where, you know, you sell a lot of records and people love you, and also the critics have to bow down to you. I would easily put her in my top five.
Number 18, as we continue the countdown, the top 30 female vocalists on pure vocal ability alone, Nina Simone.
I just finished watching, and I know I'm late to the game, Whatever Happened to Miss Simone, the documentary about her, and stunning. Just have a new found love for her. Didn't take any crap from anybody, did what she wanted to do, and absolutely, she definitely goes in the top 20.
And look at the era. I mean, there was a lot of talent just on the color of your skin that didn't get exposed the same way a white singer would be, and she broke through that, and there were a few others as well, but there were a lot who were held back. Number 17, the one, the only, Beyonce. Was she overrated? Is she overrated?
No, I've never heard of her before. Yeah. So I'm gonna say yeah. No, I don't know. Certainly, you know, with all of her accolades and Grammy Awards, you know, you have to give her props.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of people that can name one of the songs other than maybe Put a Ring on It, which is interesting. She kind of falls in that category of Drake, where a lot of hits, but did it really hit the middle of America or Canada? Do people really know what she's all about other than just her name?
All right, the next one I wouldn't have agreed with until I saw the movie. Lady Gaga.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
She can wail on the piano. She can be as subtle as you want to be. And, you know, 4-octave voice. Yeah, remarkable.
Remember when she did that tribute to The Sound of Music on one of the award shows? That's when I noticed
that
she's more than just a dance artist. It was...
If she would, and I know that this is one of the reasons why she became popular, but if she ever thought about toning down the costumes and the dressing and the meat dress and all of that, I think that she would garner a lot more respect for her singing quicker. I think people would have realized all of that, and I think that was, of course, all part of the package of being the artistic side of Lady Gaga. But if she would have just been your average dull, boring singer, I think she would have remarkably shot up faster at the top of this list.
Number 15, Etta James, at last.
Yeah.
Classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Number 14, Julie Andrews. Based on the clarity of her voice, I would imagine?
Yeah, this was a surprise.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Julie Andrews is kind of the forgotten one whenever people talk about greatest singers of all time. But not only did she become a huge star on Broadway and a performer in the UK, she didn't even want to do The Sound of Music because she was 5 months pregnant at the time. And the director said, it's okay, we'll wait. And that was a fine decision.
Wow.
So all those Disney movies, all those movies in
Mary
the beginning
Poppins.
Of her career,
yeah.
Just amazing.
13, the one and only Billie Holiday.
Yeah, I can't complain about
no.
that at all. You know, we're still talking about her 60 years after her passing. So, yeah.
Here's someone who surprised me, but I love so many great hits. Gladys Knight.
Yes, this surprised me as well. But I think it's also because she hasn't really done the hits in the last 30, 35 years, like a Dionne Warwick. You know, we put them both in the same position. Remarkable singers, but truly led the Motown revolution when it came to the late 60s, that they never looked back, that they're still feeding off of.
Number 11, Christina Aguilera, self-explanatory. Number 10, the one and only Shirley Bassey. Huh.
Yeah, another one,
yeah.
You know, three James Bond theme songs, a huge just mega star.
History
just
repeating.
Absolute. Yeah, with a propeller head.
Yes,
that's right.
So great. Oh, I love her. I love her. Annie Lennox. How did she get on there?
Because she's Annie Lennox.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. Go back on a Saturday when you're cleaning your house, and just pop on the first album right up until they broke up.
Yeah,
and you'll realize how much you're so thankful that Annie Lennox was living on the same planet as you.
Okay.
You know, every now and again, I go back to the Eurythmics music and realize just how amazingly diverse and great it truly was.
We're quickly running out of time, but I don't want to. I'm going to go over some of the classics, but for obvious reason, Tina Turner, Barbara Streisand. Don't tell Bab, she won't be happy at number 7. Karen Carpenter, the clarity of her voice clearly was something. Ella Fitzgerald, another one of the classics. Okay, now we're getting in the top 4 here.
Yeah.
Number 4, Mariah Carey.
Yeah, I'd put her at number 3.
So number 3, Celine Dion. Would you reverse the two?
I would put Celine at like 5 or 6 or so. I would.
Okay, you've lost me. I want to hang up on you. I love Celine. I know I'm one of those guys. Number 2, Aretha Franklin.
Could have been number 1.
Could have been number 1. But number 1 is Whitney Houston. So what could have been either of them, or you would have put Aretha number 1?
I would have put Whitney on there. Whitney, I think, is probably the greatest singer that's ever lived in the history of the planet of the world.
Mm.
There's nothing that she couldn't do. She was born to sing. She was born to be on this planet to sing. And what a devastating loss when she passed away. But that, without question. And she deserved to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Hey,
no question.
Christy Cameron, who's the afternoon host, said, no Lizzo on there? Too soon?
You know what? I would have put her in the bottom end of the 30 just to show how cool and hip I am.
Yeah, just for that alone. I think we're only starting to get to know what Lizzo is and her ability. She's a violinist too, right? I mean,
and plays flute. I would put a couple of more people in there. I mean, you know, just for giggles, I would have thrown in Cardi B just to upset people.
Well, you know, if it's a question of record selling, Taylor should be on there. Cardi B, absolutely. Eric, I always love talking music. I appreciate your time this morning.
Great. Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Sir, Eric Alper, music expert in this country. 11:02. We'll take a quick break for news. News Talk 580, CFRA.
This is Ottawa at Work with Leslie Roberts on News Talk 580 CFRA.
We all know that we've been affected mentally when it comes to the pandemic, but I got a number here that I'm going to start this segment with, which is actually positive. And I want to focus on this and then get into the deeper concern here that a lot of people have. So we're a year into the pandemic, and a new survey that was done by the Ontario Association of Social Workers that has been now just released shows that 2/3 of us, 64% roughly, report that the pandemic has led us to be more resilient. Let's focus on that. Almost 2/3 of us are more resilient. The problem is 45% of us apparently say that it's reported a negative shift that'll be long lasting, and in particular, the younger folks in our society. Let's break this down, find out how we can, make this shorter if possible, the recovery period. Dr. D.P. Sir is the CEO of the OASW, the Ontario Association of Social Workers, and was for many years social worker at a GTA hospital, joining us now. Good morning, Dr. Sir.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be with you.
I appreciate your time and your insight. First and foremost, I'm not surprised that the younger folks are most affected. Is it true of this generation, or is it because when you're young, maybe you just care and let things affect you more for generations since the beginning of time?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, coming off of celebrating Social Work Week last week on behalf of over 6,500 members in the association and 20,000 registered social workers across Ontario who've been on the front lines, we can tell you a couple of things about this age group. One is that absolutely they have seen a downward shift in their mental health, as you've noted. But we're not surprised that this group has seen a significant decline in their mental health. This is also a group that has had access to many supports pre-COVID as well. So we've been there on the front lines in healthcare, in schools, dealing with the opioid crisis, human trafficking, mental health and addictions.
Mm.
And so this is a group we want to pay some special attention to, because their shift in their downward decline in mental health impacts our future. What we do know and what's pretty exciting about this group is that they would also access virtual care. And so 37% of our respondents said that they'd seek virtual support. So we know virtual care is here to stay. And we want to pay special attention to this group because their bounce back is particularly important because with the right supports, they told us they could be more resilient, as you noted.
It's interesting. You didn't mention the negative effects of social media, which is the first thing that comes to mind when you're a kid today and how much harder it is because of the, well, bullying being everywhere in your life. You can't escape it.
Absolutely. And one of the places that social workers have been presently dealing with bullying, not just through COVID-19 and the pandemic and the shifts in negative mental health, have been in schools with children and youth and families. And so we know the strategic deployment of social workers in places like schools is tremendously important, especially around mental health, coping, and specifically thinking about the increase in a number of folks that are going to be dealing with long-term impacts and shifts in their negative mental health.
Talk about resilience. I'm looking for the half full as opposed to the half empty. A year later, two-thirds report the pandemic has led them to be more resilient. We're being tested and we're digging deep to be able to get through this, and many of us are okay.
Yeah, the good news is that resilience and hope is something social workers see all the time. And we know that that's what helps us pull through our negative mental health moments and the lasting impacts that these things bring. We also know that resilience is that much better with access to mental health and support. So our survey taught us a few things. Yes, it taught us how Ontarians are doing in particular, but it also told us how social workers are critical to the path forward. And in particular, I can talk to you about facilitating access.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, if I wanted to see a social worker, how hard would it be?
Yeah, what we know is social workers are everywhere. So there's 20,000 of us across the province who are regulated, working both in schools, and working in a number of settings, individuals, families, communities. We're in schools. We're in the communities, we're in shelters, we're with vulnerable populations. We're dealing with a number of things that you've seen in the media, human trafficking, the opioid crisis, and especially long-term care. And so access is not the issue, it's strategic deployment. And so what we really want to see is the leveraging of social workers' unique expertise in the right places at the right time. You know, if I can indulge you for a moment,
sure.
We were involved in a great pilot study, five GTA hospitals that placed a social worker strategically in our emergency departments during peak hours. And no surprise that during those times that the social workers addressed key things, visits such as psychosocial factors, poverty, you know, underhousing, mental health and addiction, caregiver burnout even, things that people that were appearing in the emergency departments for. And in one health network alone, we saved $1.4 million in annual costs just by being able to have a social worker there.
And how does the skill set apply to do that?
Yeah, the unique expertise of social workers is not just counseling-based. It's also recognizing the systems that influence our mental health, right? So housing, access to care, access to good financial supports. It's about navigation, treatment, assessment, and connecting people in the environments that they're in. What's unique to social workers is we're absolutely trained to do this work and we're absolutely positioned to understand a person's unique and individual environment. But we start where a person's at, so we're person-centered and really start thinking specifically about having people move through recovery in a thoughtful and meaningful way.
How much of it is therapy?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think we're always asked about, what a social worker does. And psychotherapy is certainly a way to overcome emotional behavioral problems. But I think what's really important for your listeners to hear is that what makes social workers unique and differentiates us from other mental health workers is that we have that ongoing knowledge, both from a range of counseling processes like life therapy and evidence-based work. And we're uniquely challenged to think about system navigation, connecting Ontarians to resources in the community,
yeah,
assisting them to address overall long-term impacts such as post-traumatic stress.
Well,
for example, you
dip your toes in so many things that are, you know, crucial right now.
Yeah, especially grief, bereavement, supporting folks in long-term care. We know what's been happening in terms of support and isolation and social distancing. And that doesn't preclude us from needing support in order to be resilient in the path forward, and we're essential to that work.
Talk about those working in long-term care homes, what they're seeing. I mean, in seniors who, you know, every day is a blessing because their days are numbered in terms of how many are left, they often say losing a year is losing a lifetime.
Yeah, and we know in particular, we've been hearing a lot about vaccines, right? And we know it's important to get access to vaccines. It's also about access to good social workers. And so the more social workers we can vaccinate in long-term care and other critical essential services means the better mental health support we're providing for Ontarians.
Are they not going in there now until they're vaccinated? What's the...
Yeah, we've been very thankful for the vaccine access we've had, and we know we're ramping up. And like Ontarians, we want to see as many arms as possible getting vaccinations. And so we continue to be supportive of the ramp up. But what's really crucial is, to your question, our social workers are seeing a ton of caregiver burnout and distress, and we're dealing with end of life and palliative care and supporting a number of families through long-term care. And that means the more social workers we can vaccinate, the more social workers we can deploy in long-term care, the better those vulnerable populations have access to resilience and hope.
How is the numbers in terms of people choosing social work as a career these days versus 10 years ago?
Yeah, great question. You know, social work has been a growing field. You know, our membership has been growing astronomically, which tells us folks are support. Yeah, the need is there. The folks are supporting across Ontario in rural communities. We're supporting in key essential frontline services. We're supporting both in the private and professional public spheres. And we're also partnering with our colleagues. We're part of a team, especially in hospital and community settings, in healthcare, working alongside our colleagues who are really trying to move our Ontarians forward through recovery.
Often just humanizing the situation at hand.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And it's also about enabling innovation in our healthcare service delivery. And so that's things like virtual care. And so we know virtual care is here to stay, but it's not the only answer. We know social workers have pivoted greatly to be able to support online counseling, texting through counseling services, and really trying to meet the needs of where their families and communities are at in order to promote recovery and mental health support.
For someone listening, it says, I could use the help. Where do they go?
Yeah, you can check us out at oasw.org. You know, hashtag you are not alone. We're just coming off of a great campaign for Social Work Week. You'll find a number of supports and resources there. You're connected both locally and across the province through telephone supports that have been funded by the government, through individual supports. We've also been really encouraging Ontarians to support the inclusion of social workers in their group benefit plans and insurance plans. So you can access a social worker in many different ways. Start with our website, and we point you to a number of great resources. And you have an opportunity to really get linked in.
Thank you, Dr. Sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a great day.
You as well. Dr. D.P. Sir, CEO of OASW, Ontario Association of Social Workers. We'll take a break. 11:19, News Talk 580 CFRA.
CFRA.
Hey, we got to do a shout out to retail workers. They've been through it a year now, right? And often, not that they've been overlooked, but often taken for granted as we go and get our groceries or whatever you do in the retail sector. So let's talk about the next phase of vaccinations and retail workers in particular with Carl Lidler. He's a senior VP of Public Affairs for Retail Council of Canada. Good morning.
Good morning.
Are they feeling left out, the retail workers at this point?
Well, I think that there are those who may, you know, certainly many of us, I think, would like to see a vaccination schedule that's a little faster than we've had, although we're obviously seeing more supply coming in. You know, in general, retail is a very safe environment. Mm-hmm. People may actually ask questions about that, but the Ontario government tracks cases and where they're attributable to, and typically retail is about one in every 500 cases. So, you know, that's not nothing, but it is a very low-risk environment. That said, you know, people are concerned about the variants out there now. And I think for prudence, it makes sense to, you know, vaccinate retail workers as soon as is possible. Obviously, there are other priorities out there, be that people with respiratory conditions or, you know, those of us, you know, advanced age, and we understand that they take priority. But I think we are anticipating that retail should be part of phase two, and indeed that's what the government's announced.
So generally, if we look at the list, after those who might be seen as vulnerable populations, but ahead of the general public.
Yeah, now, I mean, you know, to put that in perspective, phase two looks to vaccinate something in the order of, I think, 6.5 or 7 million people. I'm going by memory now. So that's a very large tranche of the population.
It is.
And retail is toward the back end of that. It is in what they call cannot work from home category.
Right.
Retail workers have some priority in that, particularly in pharmacy and grocery. But, you know, that's slated for June currently, so we're not talking about something that's right around the corner.
You know, you talk about the low issue within retail in terms of numbers of transmission, but you're a lot of people who were not only working in retail but vulnerable, for example, they walked away to protect their own health. We forget about them.
Yeah, and I mean, there have been a bunch of programs to help try and address that. So those who were in a retail environment and had maybe pre-existing conditions or, you know, were themselves, well advanced in age, retailers in many cases tried to find ways to accommodate them in other functions. There were some support programs, including furloughing through the federal wage support program. So there was some work to do that. But obviously, you know, if you have a more than typical exposure, you're going to want to look at it a little differently than the general population.
I always look for the silver lining here. At least we're talking about a vaccine rollout now and where it should go next, as opposed to what we spoke about just a few months ago.
Yeah, it was like chicken and egg for a while,
yeah.
Or maybe leapfrog. You know, you had an
well
issue
said.
with supply, even though it looked like they might have the distribution set up. Now you've got a situation where the supply seems to be coming, and it's a question of how fast the rollout can go. So, but, you know, that's a nice problem to have, right, that you're, you know, trying to kind of move things to market pretty quickly.
Mr. Lidler, thank you. Appreciate your time this morning.
You're very welcome. Thanks.
Carl Lidler, Senior VP Public Affairs, the Retail Council of Canada, coming up to 11:27. We'll take a break. News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is...